Thanks again for having me. And feel free to interrupt me at any time, obviously, with questions. I prefer a dialogue a little more than just talking at people for 45 minutes straight. So, like Will said, I'm Mike Zevin, and I'm a finishing graduate student at Northwestern University. List of a lot of collaborators that are going to be parts of some of the papers that I'm going to be talking about throughout this talk. And I got to really appreciate, I was at another university and I had a samurai sword as a pointer, and I was like, there's no way that that's ever going to get topped as far as a pointer, but I think it just did, because it's hard to beat a hockey stick when you're in Canada. So what today I'm really going to try to kind of present and explain to you is really how our view and our scientific goals have changed as far as the field of gravitational waves have gone. So this is something that, as someone from inside the LIGO collaboration, I've really started to appreciate over the past couple years. But as when we look at this field 4 or 5 years ago, really the primary scientific goal was to be able to make the detection of these minuscule perturbations in space-time. And in 2015, we all know that we did. But over the past 3 or 4 years, we've done more than just do that, and we've really started to build the beginnings of a population of these types of compact binary mergers. So we're looking at the spectrograms of the 10 publicly announced binary black holes that LIGO has observed in the first and second observing run. And of course, we have everybody's favorite binary neutron star merger as well. And to me, though, detection and characterization and data analysis are still very important. Some of the driving questions that I think have really been coming out of the woodwork over the past few years is thinking about the properties of the sources and the populations as a whole. So where did these sources come from? What can they tell us about massive star evolution, and how the progenitors actually ended their lives and formed these compact objects? Now, this is especially pertinent now because, as I'm sure most of us know, the 11 sources that we have here isn't comprehensive of everything we've detected to date so far. LIGO has already completed the first half of its third observing run, and this is all, thankfully, public knowledge now. At least a lot of the kind of source immediate source characterizations are public knowledge at gracedb.ligo.org. And in the first 6 months of the third observing run, we already have over 20 new binary black hole, significant binary black hole candidates. So we more than tripled our population that we had from the first two observing runs. So this talk is really going to be broken up into two aspects. My research is mostly focused on kind of the astrophysical interpretation of these systems and how we can use it to learn more about massive star evolution and the population of compact binaries out there. And in the first part, I'm going to really be focusing just on the black hole binaries that LIGO detects. So binary black holes are detected at a higher rate than any other compact binary merger from ground-based detectors. And like I said, we currently have a catalog of over 30 of these to start to decipher kind of where they came from and how they formed. Now, there have been plenty of kind of suggestions for how binary black holes come to be in our universe, but they can broadly fall under two kind of general canonical categories. So on the left side, you see a cartoon of isolated evolution, which is really when you have two massive stars that are born in an isolated binary, no perturbations from other outside sources. They go through kind of their co-evolution together, leaving behind a kind of tight, compact binary orbit that can merge within a Hubble time. And the other side of this is dynamical assembly. And I have a picture of a globular cluster here, though there are different kind of environments where these black holes have been proposed to be dynamically assembled. But the key difference from this scenario is that the black holes that go and merge as a LIGO source didn't start in the same system. They started in kind of unique systems that went through their evolution separately, which can have important implications for kind of the final parameters that we see for the black holes. Now, this is a really, really simplified scenario. In reality, each one of these two canonical channels have a number of kind of subchannels that have their own unique predictions for binary black hole rates and source properties. And there have been a good number of other channels that have also been proposed, such as evolution of black holes and migration traps and AGN disks, triple systems, either in the galactic center, interacting with the supermassive black hole, or field triple systems of three stellar mass black holes, population three stars, and primordial black holes. So really, the question is quite a complicated one, but one that we might be able to start to disentangle with this growing population of binary black holes. The really name of the game becomes, how can we take these systems and these predicted formation scenarios and find kind of unique predictions that can map these backwards to one of these particular environments. And I think of it a lot like this. I mean, when you're kind of presented with a population, it helps to have some kind of things to guide you, some aspect to guide you, some characteristics that are unique to one kind of formation scenario compared to others. Because once you know that black holes should be wearing striped sweaters and holding canes and wearing glasses, then you might be able to kind of back out. I spoiled it for those of you that were still looking, but we only have 50 minutes here. So then you might be able to pin down kind of sources that are unique to one particular environment and can't be explained by others. So obviously black holes don't wear sweaters and glasses and hold canes. So what properties are we talking about when we're talking about these kind of distinguishing characteristics? Well, clearly we have the black hole masses, how heavy these black holes are, the relative masses, so the mass ratio of the merger itself, the spin magnitude, how fast they're spinning and the direction they're spinning relative to one another, their orbital eccentricity, so how stretched out their orbits are when they enter the LIGO-sensitive frequency range, and the redshifts and redshift evolution of these systems. And one of the great things about one of these channels, particularly formation and globular clusters, is that it makes pretty unique predictions about all of these relative to kind of the other canonical formation channels out there. So this is a great simulation from one of the globular cluster models that we use at Northwestern. This was made with data from one of my collaborators, Carl Rodriguez, but we're looking at kind of the black hole subsystem at the cores of these globular clusters. And we're gonna talk more about how these black holes get to the cores and the types of interactions that they can have that give us kind of unique properties as far as LIGO sources go. So traditionally, the parameter of black holes that's been discussed in terms of kind of distinguishing these different channels, like were they born alone or were they born in this dense cluster, has been spins. And this is kind of a really simple, one of the reasons that I think it's been discussed quite a bit is it's kind of a very, very simple argument. So dynamical assembled black holes, like I said before, they start in individual systems that aren't related to one another. But then through strong exchange encounters, they come to meet their final partner. And because these two black holes evolved in isolation, their spin should have no kind of understanding of the other black hole's spin whatsoever. So if these things are getting spin up in some way when they come as their final pair, their spin vector should be completely isotropically distributed relative to one another. Whereas in the isolated evolution scenario, you have mass transfer and tides and things that are kind of exchanging information between these two stellar progenitors. And most modeling suggests that the spin vectors will be aligned to some degree, aligned with each other and aligned with the orbital angular momentum. There's a tilde here because one aspect that misaligns the spins is the supernova that forms these black holes. So for lower mass black holes, it's predicted that the kick from the asymmetries in the supernova itself can kind of misalign their spins with the orbital angular momentum. But that should go down as a function of black hole mass. So in some pretty early work that we did, we just said, well, let's just take models of these two different channels. So we have models of binaries that are formed dynamically, and we have models of binaries that are formed in isolation. And let's look at how their spins change, particularly as a function of the mass of these black holes. So in this plot over here, I'm showing as a function of the chirp mass, which I'm sure people have heard here before. It's this kind of parameter that we measure very well with gravitational waves. And we're showing how the percent of systems with negative chi effectives changes as a function of chirp mass. For those of you that haven't heard of this parameter, it's our best measured spin parameter as far as gravitational waves go. It's kind of like a mass-weighted mass-weighted spin vector of the projection along the angular momentum. So it's essentially how aligned or misaligned these spins are. And for globular clusters, you can see the fraction that have negative effective spins right here is the straight line at 50%, and this just comes from the isotropy of their kind of formation scenarios. Whereas for field binaries, which are represented by these different blue and red curves, which are telling us about different kind of supernova kick prescriptions, we see for most of the realistic prescriptions that the fraction that have negative effective spins precipitously drops as a function of mass for the exact reason that I was saying before. This was back in the day when we only had two things that we needed to put on plots. It would be messier now when we have 10. But this was really kind of just a prediction that if you see a system that has a high mass and an anti-aligned spin, so a spin that's aligned away from the angular momentum, it's a pretty clear indication that it came from some kind of dynamical formation scenario. Now, that means we can kind of wipe our hands and say, okay, we're done, we figured it out, we have a way to kind of distinguish between these kind of main channels of black hole formation, but unfortunately the universe wasn't too kind to us as far as that particular prediction goes, because most of the black holes that we've observed by LIGO have spins and really these chi effective parameters consistent with zero. So this could mean really one of two things. It can mean either black holes just truly have very low natal spins, or that the spin vectors of the black holes are kind of preferentially aligned in the orbital plane. Both of those would give you an effective spin of zero. But kind of motivated by the observations that LIGO has had, people, yeah, go ahead.
Could it be the case that we have some kind of selection bias when we are trying to find sources in LIGO data?
Yeah, totally. And one of them that definitely comes up is the selection bias that we have against finding negative effective spin systems. So when you have a black hole that has their spins pointed opposite of the angular momentum, then they stay in the LIGO band for a shorter period of time and build up less SNR, and they're harder to detect compared to someone a binary black hole that has spins aligned with the angular momentum. So that's one kind of selection effect. But the nice part about gravitational waves is we understand our selection effects pretty well. There's not a lot of, because it's a relatively clean population because we know how our detection probability scales with mass and how it changes with the effective spin and things like that. So those are things we typically try to take into account.
Yeah. So I see the price you pay if you misalign or anti-align the spins, but you also have the mass. So you can definitely try changing, considering slightly lower masses than those things that you're saying, okay, now they're outside the light band, mm-hmm. We come back in. So it shouldn't be a very strong influence.
So it's really the amount of cycles that you have in the LIGO band. So not.
I would give you mm-hmm. a binary that has slightly lower masses.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I have as many cycles as I want.
Yeah, but the problem is, yeah, so if you have more cycles, if you have a large number of cycles in band with a lower mass binary, then yeah, the selection effect isn't as strong. But for the 30 solar mass black holes that we're detecting where we only capture a cycle and a half or two cycles, this is kind of problematic. And from some work, at least for 30 solar mass black holes, I think something that's maximally spinning anti-aligned compared to maximally spinning aligned, you detect about a factor of 5 less of them. So getting back to kind of these low spins, many studies have come out over the past few years and actually before that that have said that maybe angular momentum transport in these kind of stellar progenitors to black holes is quite efficient, which would naturally lead to kind of diminished spins when these black holes form. And this is a plot from Jim Fuller and Linhao Ma's paper looking at the kind of black holes that LIGO has detected and the IES search pipeline has detected with the scatter points and the predictions for black hole spins for single stars and for a number of binary types of cases. And besides a couple scenarios, such as tidal spin-up and chemically homogeneous evolution, they find that most of their black holes in their models actually do form with low spins, close, very, very close to zero, so dimensionless spins of 0.01 or so. And since the binary black holes that form in clusters typically form in systems that would be in isolation or not going through one of these kind of unique binary scenarios, it might be reasonable to predict that most black holes in clusters may actually have low spins as well. So this isn't good for the trying to distinguish these things based on their spin vectors and the alignment of their spin vectors, but it does open up a really interesting other avenue that might be able to kind of put cluster binary black holes in a unique part of parameter space. And this has to do with something called either the upper mass gap or the pair instability mass gap. So the plot I'm showing here is from one of our LIGO papers that came out with the second LIGO catalog. The first LIGO catalog after the second observing run. And on this kind of panel, we're looking at how the core mass right before collapse changes as a function of the initial mass of the star for a few different metallicities. And you see that there are these two kind of gaps that come up. This top one is the one that I'm talking about. And this top gap actually results from a scenario called pair instability. And the idea is that in massive helium cores, you actually can have pair production happen in these cores. So you take a high energy photon and convert it to electron-positron pair. From those of us that remember our kind of beginning astronomy, there's this thing called hydrostatic equilibrium. It's this balance between gravity pushing inward and radiation pressure pushing outward. So as you limit the number of these photons in the core, you get an instability that can cause the core to collapse on a dynamical timescale. As it collapses, it heats up very rapidly and can start burning heavier elements. And this can either cause instabilities that kind of blow out a lot of material in the star or cause the star to explode entirely. So this is a pretty robust theoretical prediction and says that between about 60 and 130 solar masses, we really don't expect to have any binary black holes come from isolated evolution. Now, if you look at this plot carefully, though, you'll notice that LIGO has already observed black holes that lie in this gap. Now, these aren't the black holes, the components that are the black squares here, but it's the triangles here which represent the merger products of these black holes. So when two of these merge, they obviously make a bigger black hole, and some of these kind of second generation black holes do lie in this pair instability gap. Now, if those red dots, those new black holes that were kind of forged from these collisions could go on to merge again, then it could give us a unique signal because it's something that single star evolution really can't produce. Now, for those red triangles to go on and merge again, they, number one, need to be in some kind of dynamically rich and active environment, and number two, need to stay in that dynamically rich and active environment after they merge. So the problem with that is there is this effect called a relativistic recoil kick or a gravitational wave recoil kick. And the moral of the story is when two black holes merge, their instantaneous emission is anisotropic. So at merger itself, that remnant product will get a kick, will get a momentum boost essentially. And that momentum boost is determined by both the spins of the black holes and the mass ratio of the black holes. But let's say that we were able to retain these things in a cluster. Then you would start to see two kind of interesting things come out of the data. Number one, as you merge two black holes, you'll obviously make a bigger black hole, like I said, that can maybe occupy the gap. And number two, that new black hole is then gonna kind of gain the angular momentum from the orbit prior to its merger, and will be spinning at a relatively high spin rate, even if the component black holes that formed it were non-spinning. So now you have something that's highly spinning and possibly more massive than what can be formed with single star evolution. Now.
So for a cluster, right? So you say velocity is typically like a few kilometers per second.
Sorry? Right.
A few kilometers per second.
So for an open cluster, that would be pretty reasonable. For the kind of old metal poor globular clusters that I'm talking about, the present day escape velocities range from about 30 to 50 kilometers per second.
Like the dispersions I thought are smaller.
The dispersion velocity are tens of kilometers per second in globular clusters. But one key thing is that, I mean, even 30 to 50 kilometers per second is pretty wimpy. I mean, it's pretty easy for these things, even with a mass ratio of 0.9, to be able to escape. But what's important is that, and I'm not going to mention this in the talk, so I'll take a little aside to mention this, is that globular clusters are expected to be much heavier earlier in their lives. So these things all formed 10 gig a year ago. They're expected to be 2 to 3, maybe even more times more massive at early times compared to what we see them as today. So they have a deeper potential. And the escape velocities at some of these early times could possibly be more like 100, maybe even up to 200 kilometers per second for the densest globular clusters. All right, so let's actually look at what our globular cluster models say as far as these second generation black holes. I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead.
In your global cluster models, what's a typical mass ratio then?
The median mass ratio is just above 0.8. So it strongly prefers equal mass. But like I was saying, even at mass ratios of 0.8, non-spinning, that might be enough of a kick to make it leave the cluster if we didn't have more massive clusters at these earlier times. Yeah, but it definitely pushes towards equal mass. So this is taking a snapshot of one of our cluster models where we artificially set all the birth spins of the first generation of black holes to zero. So if these kind of predictions from stellar modeling are correct, then say that most black holes have very, very low spins. And we're looking at a kind of 2D histogram in the two component masses of the black holes here. And each one of these squares is colored based on essentially how many black holes are sitting in that particular histogram bin. But you notice that some of these are colored as well. The colors are showing the bins where most of the systems are contain a black hole that already went through a previous merger. So in these orange bins, we're seeing things where one of the two black holes is a second generation, so one of the two already went through a merger. And in the green bins, we're looking at systems where both of the black holes already went through a merger scenario and then went on to merge again. So you can see that these black holes here are really pushing to both extreme spaces and mass, as well as mass ratio, and like I said before, might have even unique kind of spin signatures as well. And if you kind of crank the numbers and incorporate selection effects, because it's easier to detect massive black holes compared to less massive black holes, you find that more than if you assume that kind of the birth spins are zero or very small for globular cluster black holes, you find that more than 20% of detectable mergers from globular clusters have one of these second generation components. And about 7% should have one of them with a mass above 55 solar masses, so above this kind of nominal parent stability limit. So the really nice thing about this prediction is that no matter how you turn the crank at the uncertain spin magnitudes of black holes, dynamical formation channels are going to give you a unique way of distinguishing some of their black holes compared to the isolated scenario. The first option is if you have large kind of spin magnitudes for the first generation of black holes, you'll eventually see some population show up in the data that has negative effective spins. But if you turn it the other way and you assume that most black holes have very, very low spin magnitudes, then you won't see any kind of distinguishing signs from the first generation of systems. But when you start to have these kind of higher generations build up, you might see things that have abnormally high masses and abnormally high spins, even if the first generation was initially non-spinning. Go ahead.
Taking this thought, what did you assume about the distribution of the first generation of black holes?
So we, what did I do? Okay, good. So we essentially use a stellar evolution code. So we populate in IMF, so an initial mass function for the initial stars. And then we evolve these stars to black hole formation. And the remnant black holes that are there are going to be the ones that's essentially going to define our mass distribution of the initial population. That's highly dependent on things like metallicity, but we have a good idea of what the metallicity of kind of the globular clusters in the Milky Way are. So we have a few metallicities that we run these at.
And so the first generation peaks around 20 or 30 solar masses?
So the first generation black holes peak at much lower masses than that. But in these dynamical environments, you actually have a strong preference for kind of creating new binaries with the more massive components. So the way that these binaries are made, and you'll see that in a few slides, is that you have these kind of strong chaotic encounters between three or four bodies in these clusters. But statistically, the more massive of those components will result in the bound system, and the less massive will be ejected from that interaction. So that's how you kind of build up these higher masses in clusters.
Cool, so that's a good point. So the first generation will involve behavior mass.
I'm sorry, can you say that again? I just...
The first binary will involve the heavier mass black holes. Now, if you are thinking, okay, this is probably the second generation merger, or I don't know how you count first.
Yeah, you're doing it right, yeah.
What would be the mass ratio? That would be, do you also be preferentially getting the third heavier mass?
Yeah, ratio? So that's totally true, and that's actually the only reason why we see anything that have going through these kind of 2G, 2G merger projects. Typically, you don't have many second generation black holes in the cluster, but they dominate the dynamics and they'll more likely find another heavy component to form a binary with. And if that heavy component kind of forms a binary and then has a kind of recoil that kicks it out of the cluster, then you have this heavy binary evolving in isolation and leading to merger. So yeah, that's exactly right. Now, one of the things that I've been kind of the most interested in is another prediction that comes from globular clusters, which is eccentricity. eccentricity is something that I think has been not ignored, but not appreciated as much as far as signals that LIGO can detect. These are coming out of the famous paper that everyone in gravitational wave community uses, Peters 64, and this is just looking at how the eccentricity scales with the semi-major axis. So as gravitational waves kind of emit radiation, they tend to circularize the binary, so the eccentricity really becomes more and more circular as the binary hardens. But the other interesting thing, just to keep in mind, is that the in-spiral time is strongly dependent on the eccentricity as well. So something that has an eccentricity at formation of 0.99 will merge orders of magnitude quicker than something that has eccentricity of zero, so a circular binary. Now, thinking about how we can create eccentric binaries in globular clusters, I should mention that kind of the key here is that if things are in spiraling over a very long time, so more than 10 to the 5 years or so, really any measurable semblance of eccentricity is going to be gone if they're in spiraling in isolation. So you need to kind of forge these highly eccentric things very, very quick. And it turns out that globular clusters are kind of a prime place for doing this. Now, I kind of hinted at this before, but in the segregated kind of cores of these clusters, so the idea is that black holes through mass segregation will kind of collapse to the cores of these clusters. And the densities, the number densities of stellar objects in these cores can actually reach about 1,000,000 per cubic parsec. So right here where we are in the Milky Way, the typical number density of stars is about 1 per cubic parsec. I mean, the nearest star is about, we're about the only one in our parsec cube that we're in. So this is about 1,000,000 times more dense than kind of the environments in the Milky Way, which is why these kind of strong dynamical encounters, these strong gravitational encounters, are kind of a commonplace thing that happens. But the encounters that happen with different black hole components, these black holes, I mean, they have a very, very small size, right? So you can actually have these things moving at significantly relativistic speeds, so highly relativistic speeds. And if you have essentially encounters that kind of create a binary that has a high enough eccentricity, it can cause them to actually merge from gravitational wave radiation, because during these periapse passages, it's essentially emitting so much energy in gravitational waves that it just drives it to a very, very rapid merger. So one of the reasons that I think this was ignored for a while is because the people that do the modeling of these dynamical encounters and these dynamical environments, for a long time were ignoring post-Newtonian effects, so ignoring relativistic effects. So I mean, this is just kind of a really toy example looking at two black holes on an eccentric orbit at a very kind of tight orbital separation. When you just include Newtonian gravity, I mean, these things just kind of going on in their orbits, but post-Newtonian effects, so higher orders of V over C, will actually introduce important changes to the evolution of these systems, the dynamical evolution of these systems. So the 1 and the 2 PN orders, I mean, they're a mess to code up, so this is essentially the acceleration term that gets added to your Newtonian acceleration when you include these terms. But these are what, they're non-dissipative terms, so they govern periapse precession, so similar to like the periapse precession of Mercury. And the 2.5 PN term is the first term where orbital decay actually comes in, so where gravitational waves actually kick in. So when you actually account for all these higher orders in the acceleration, the evolution of this binary is going to be quite a bit different. It's going to look more like this. So you notice that the periapse is precessing, you're getting these rosette orbits, and you're also losing orbital energy and in spiraling until it drives it to an eventual merger. Now, this is a very toy example. Let's look at an example that actually comes from our globular cluster models. So this is from a paper I had last year. But what we're going to be looking at is we're going to be looking at a binary-binary interaction. So these are two binary black holes that are interacting in one of these kind of cluster cores and going through these chaotic encounters. So at the first approach, we see that one of the four objects immediately gets ejected from this interaction, leaving kind of this hardened three-body state. These would make really good screensavers. I was thinking about leaving academia and just like, no one uses screensavers anymore, though. But one of the interesting things that you can see is you often, even though these three bodies are still bound, you create these kind of temporary metastable binaries. And each one of these times you create one of these metastable binaries, it's drawing its eccentricity essentially from a quasi-thermal distribution. So create enough of these and you're eventually going to generate one that has a very, very high eccentricity. Now, if Newtonian gravity was only being considered, this would go on until one of the three objects went away. But in this case, now we're zooming in at that one binary that I circled and slowing down time. In this case, one of these binaries had a very, very kind of highly eccentric, one of these intermediate binaries had a very high eccentricity drawn, which drove it to essentially in-spiral and merge during this chaotic encounter itself on the order of thousands of seconds. So in this case, it can actually still retain significant eccentricity as it enters the LIGO band. But how significant? This plot is actually looking at the eccentricity distribution for three different kind of subpopulations that come from globular clusters. You can also notice that these eccentricity distributions are strongly tied to their in-spiral times, as I was kind of hinting before. We're looking at in-spiral times here as a function of eccentricity. So lower eccentricity is at the top and higher eccentricity is at the bottom. This gray distribution is looking at kind of the ejected population from clusters. So these are ones that go through one of these chaotic encounters and leave the encounter with a velocity that essentially ejects it from the cluster. So then it evolves essentially just from gravitational wave emission until it merges. The orange population is looking at ones that are in cluster mergers. So these are ones that leave one of these chaotic encounters, but have such a high eccentricity and small semi-major axis that they merge before the next chaotic encounter happens. Typically happen on mega-year timescales. And this blue population here is the one that I'm most interested in as far as LIGO sources go. This is similar to the one that you saw in that movie before. These are ones that actually lead to a highly eccentric merger during this chaotic encounter itself. So what can LIGO actually distinguish? So there are kind of two counter effects that are happening with LIGO and eccentricity. You want more eccentricity in your signal to be able to distinguish it from circular, but the more eccentricity you have, the harder it's going to be to detect with our kind of circular searches that we have for the data, because LIGO uses circular aligned spin templates when searching the data. But as far as measurability, some work has found that any for a 1509-14-like system with an eccentricity above about 0.05, we would be able to distinguish it as eccentric from circular. So this actually cuts this blue distribution right about in half. From our cluster models, we find about 10% of black holes fall into this blue distribution, and then about half of those might be measurable by LIGO. So we're looking at about 5% of all the black holes from globular clusters with eccentricities that could possibly be attainable and measurable by LIGO. As far as these other populations go, eccentricity won't really be able to help us distinguish between these and kind of their isolated counterparts. But as we move to lower frequencies, such as the LISA band, these things will have a higher eccentricity in the LISA band because they've been evolving for less. They're at a lower gravitational wave frequency. And now we're looking at kind of their eccentricity in the bucket of the LISA band. And anything below this kind of dashed line for these dashed curves might be measurable. So LISA may actually be able to kind of distinguish these different subpopulations from their isolated counterparts as well. Yeah, sorry.
Yes, you mentioned that for an eccentric system like GW, with the parameters of GW1509-14, as far as the mass is concerned, would it have been caught with the template search or the burst search?
Yeah, so the second, so with the template search depends on how eccentric you want it to make it. So typically things below about an eccentricity of 0.1, they're not going to lose too much SNR from being eccentric from the circular searches. As far as how far, so I mean, another component of that is for this kind of fiducial 1509-14 like system, we have similar masses and a similar SNR, which is talking about a similar luminosity distance to some degree. As far as how, so 1509-14 was picked up by burst searches. As far as whether if it was a highly, highly eccentric one that really only appears in the burst searches and not the mesh filtering searches, I'm not sure what luminosity distance it would need to be at. But that's a really good question because that's important for ever hoping to pick out those kind of populations there.
Yeah, on the follow-up, are you aware of whether efforts within LIGO to try and look for this kind of repeated bursts that would happen in this highly eccentric system?
Yeah, so there are, sorry, I'm not sure what happened to the screen here. So there are burst searches that LIGO does, as many of you I'm sure know. So rather than looking at kind of template waveforms, I think it's coming back up now, maybe. There we go. I don't know what happened. All right. Yeah, we're good. So instead of looking kind of at a signal that comes right at a GR, like an in-spiral signal that comes out at GR, they just look kind of for kind of correlated, coherent noise between the two detectors. I'm definitely not an expert in these burst searches, but that's going to be super important, especially for this population. This kind of peak that you see near an eccentricity of 1 are systems that actually form within the LIGO band. So they're a hyperbolic encounter that literally gets formed at a frequency higher than 10 hertz. And those are really going to be near impossible to find with your circular searches.
So a related question. So I mean, I presume to put that limit for the solid bind, you had to have some model that includes eccentricity for the merger of the waveform, because that's basically all we solve for that event.
So there are eccentric waveform models. I'm trying to remember which particular family was used for that paper. I'd have to look at the paper itself. There are eccentric waveform models, but they're really expensive. And trying to create a template bank of them is adding another dimension to your template space. So it's really a tough problem to do to actually cover eccentricity fully.
I know don't include these very high eccentricities, right?
Yeah.
Or at least haven't been tested against them.
Mm-hmm. So that paper wasn't really looking at these kind of extremal eccentricities. It was just looking at essentially how eccentric 1509-14 needed to be able to tell it was eccentric. So probably nothing higher than 0.2 or so, I'm guessing. But yeah, so it's a real big problem kind of generating models for these very highly eccentric signals. So I've talked about now kind of three different unique ways that dynamics gives you unique properties in your binary black holes, but clearly that's not the only thing that can be done. So even when you don't have a single signal with a very kind of unique characteristic, a population is still going to be able to tell you some pretty interesting things. So this is a plot looking at the masses and the effective spins of the black holes from the first catalog. So for the 11, the 10 black holes and the neutron star binary as well. And from this information, we're actually able to already pick apart some kind of interesting things that come from the data. So by constructing kind of phenomenological models meant to represent the mass and spin distributions of these black holes, we were able to kind of make fits to these models based on the data itself. And one of the things that this told us is that, at least according to these phenomenological models that have some kind of drop-off at high masses meant to represent kind of the parent stability gap, we see that more than 99% of black holes in the universe have masses that are less than 45 solar masses. So this is the source population, not the detected population. Obviously, we see heavier things easier. And as far as the spins go, just the fact that we see most of these things with chi effectives consistent with zero tells us that data already rules out highly spinning aligned systems. But one of the things that I've been interested in doing that I think is going to be really nice for tying this back to our uncertainties in massive star evolution information channels is instead of using kind of these phenomenological representations for the distributions, use the outputs of kind of our population models themselves. So in this plot, if you just look at, don't worry about the filled histogram, the dashed one is the detection weighted distribution coming from different formation scenarios. The right panel are ones coming from clusters and the left panel are ones coming from field. But as we move to different rows, we actually changed kind of the prescription for supernova natal kicks. So how strong this natal kick is a function of mass for the most part. So our total population that comes from these channels or these models is really parameterized by both the branching fraction between the channels, so how many come from channel A compared to channel B, and also the physical prescriptions that embed these channels themselves. So which of these supernova kicks, for example, is the correct one for describing the black holes in the universe. So I'm not going to get into this because I'm running a little short on time, but one of the ways that you can really start to measure these types of things is through a technique called hierarchical inference. Essentially, These branching fractions and physical prescriptions make up hyperparameters to your model, and you can kind of measure posterior distributions on these particular hyperparameters themselves. So what can we do as far as branching ratios go? With 10 observations, what we're looking at here, each column is a different kind of injected branching fraction. So this is not using LIGO data at all. This is just drawing 10 observations from some combination of these models with one particular kick prescription. And we're looking at how we converge on the correct branching ratio as a function of the number of observations. So with 10 observations, regardless of what the injected ratio is, we don't really have strong convergence whatsoever. But this is more just kind of a qualitative point as you move to higher and higher numbers of detections, 30, 100, 300, and 1,000, you actually really start to converge quite well on the true injected branching fraction and limit kind of your biases in your individual realization. So the lighter ones are individual realizations, and you really see that those start to kind of converge on the true injected value. As far as the kind of physical prescriptions underlying these population models, what we're looking at here is we're looking at kind of the injected kick prescription. So for this case, fallback kicks was injected against the other two kick prescriptions. And on the y-axis, we're looking at the Bayes factor as a function of the number of observations. So moral of the story, the higher the Bayes factor goes, the more likely one model is compared to the one that you're comparing it with. And once again, we find that regardless of the kind of underlying branching fraction between clusters and field, we start to kind of find a preferred kick prescription kind of very rapidly as we get to 100 or even 1,000 observations. So kind of an interesting route down the road. So I got to the halfway point in my talk, and it's already 1:45. So I'm going to not talk about all of these different things, but the second kind of part of the talk, I wanted to really talk about what you can do with neutron star observations, both ones from gravitational waves, ones that we see electromagnetically, or short gamma ray bursts, and even ones that happened many, many giga-year ago based on how they kind of contaminated their host environments, such as globular clusters. I'm not going to be able to get to nearly all of this, so if you're interested in hearing more, I'm here all today and tomorrow, so please come and talk to me. But one thing that I really wanted to touch on is how GRBs can really be informative of massive star evolution. So in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to quickly cover that.
We start a little late.
Okay, last 45 minutes do I have left? Or no, well, I'll try to make it pretty quick. So we all have seen these pictures before. We know that 170817 was really a beacon of a perfect multi-messenger source that we had. But one of the things that I think has been thought about doing before is by essentially looking at the, because of the electromagnetic signal that we saw from the kilonova, we actually see that it merged offset to the center of its host galaxy by a little bit. When you take the distance and the angular separation, that ends up being about 2.2 kiloparsecs. And one of the things that we were thinking about doing is how can we use this limited amount of information, like the masses that we get from gravitational waves, as well as the host association and the offset from electromagnetic observations, to start to understand some of the processes that led to its formation. So the kick that it received at supernova, how much mass was lost in the supernova, the pre-supernova separation, and maybe even the birth location inside of its host galaxy. So double neutron stars are something that we do know. We do have a sample here in our Milky Way. I think as of now, we have something like 19 double neutron star systems, plus or minus 5. Just minus 5, we definitely don't have more than 20. But with the double neutron stars in the Milky Way, we already have some interesting information about kind of the supernova kicks that led to their formation. So isolated pulsars, we've known for a long time that they do have a velocity relative to their local standard of rest, that's what LSR means. And oftentimes this velocity is modeled as a Maxwellian distribution, and the kind of interpretation of this is that neutron stars get kicked at formation. So there's some asymmetry process in the supernova explosion that essentially kicks this newly formed compact object and makes it start moving in a way that's different from its kind of local standard of rest. For binaries, this is quite a bit more complicated. Now, double neutron stars, I mean, they go through a pretty complicated process as a binary. And when we look at their kind of velocity relative to their local standard of rest, we see that they're typically smaller than this distribution that we see here. But their velocity is not indicative of the natal kick that it received in the supernova itself. Because you have a binary now, you also have mass loss in the supernova. And this mass loss is in a frame that's not in the center of mass of the binary itself. So when you lose mass in this kind of non-center of mass frame, it's going to lead to a barycentric velocity kick as well. So when you have these binaries that undergo a supernova, you have both the mass loss kick, which is often called the Blau kick, as well as the natal kick, so the kick from the asymmetry in the supernova explosion itself. And you can do some tricks to kind of back out what the natal kick might be. And this is what this plot is now showing as well. We see that typically, at least for some of these, we see a lot of double neutron stars have kicks that are much lower than what would be expected from this isolated distribution. This might be because of a broader range for something called an electron capture supernova or stripping that goes on from the binary interactions. But we see a couple that are consistent with kicks above 100 kilometers per second as well. So is there this bimodality? Are these things going through different formation processes? What's actually happening in the supernova? These are still kind of really unanswered questions and might be able to tell us a lot about binary evolution and supernova physics itself. So now we have this population that we're starting to see outside the Milky Way. The first double neutron star we played this game with, we essentially explored the parameter space of kind of the supernova physics that can happen. So how strong the kick was, how much mass was lost in the supernova, what its pre-supernova orbital separation was. We planted these kind of seed tracers in the host galaxy of 170817 and followed their kinematic evolution until they merged. So this was a paper that I led for the LIGO collaboration that came out with the 170817 discovery. And essentially what we did was we took a slice of the mergers, the ones that actually merged in the correct offset, and looked at their properties, examined their properties, and saw the ones that are consistent with giving us that final offset. Unfortunate thing is, since this thing wasn't offset too far from its host, we weren't really able to have much constraining power as far as the kind of supernova physics. But nonetheless, we got a nice movie made out of it. So this is looking at the evolution of one of these tracers on its kind of pre-supernova circular orbit in the galaxy. Then it got kicked from the supernova explosion and is evolving through this galactic potential. That's what this white blob is, in case you didn't know it. I don't know if it really looks like a galaxy. And we're kind of now changing the viewing angle and showing this thing's evolution. It would be a complete mystery to when it merges, except we have this nice kind of counter in the upper left-hand corner. So I have to kill time for another 3 seconds. But then it merges, and this is what a gamma ray burst looks like. And now we're looking at kind of the distribution of many of these different tracers. We did this kind of game with millions of particles in this galaxy. And finding it, the ones that all merge is essentially the correct projected offset, which is why we see this kind of circle here when we take this one 2D projection of the three-dimensional galaxy. So these are all ones that merge with the location consistent with 170817. Like I said, this didn't really lead to strong constraints on the progenitors. It was relatively consistent with what we saw with Milky Way binaries. But we do have a population that might have a much stronger constraining power, and that's actually short gamma ray bursts. So we know of many of these short gamma ray bursts that are highly offset from their hosts. And we call these things hostless gamma ray bursts, even though they do have a kind of a probable host. In this case, the most probable host is this G1 galaxy. But this gamma ray burst is about 30 kiloparsec offset from the center of this galaxy. And for a long time, kind of the offset distributions of gamma ray bursts has been kind of an indirect piece of evidence that these things came from a double compact object formation scenario, because these things are susceptible to kicks at formation that can possibly lead them to these high offsets. So this is just looking at kind of the offset distribution of short gamma ray bursts compared to some other transients and showing that it pushes to higher offsets. So what we did recently is we played the same kind of game, but doing it in a much more sophisticated way. We modeled kind of the host galaxies of some of these highly offset short gamma ray bursts, and we followed the kinematic evolution of progenitor systems through this galactic potential. This time we actually took into account star formation history and galaxy evolution as a function of time. So I'm doing a little bit more of a sophisticated job than we did with 170817. But one of the things that we did in this as well is we also combined information that we have from double neutron star population modeling. So rather than just having kind of flat prior information on the kicks and the separations, we actually base it on physical population models instead that can help us understand essentially the offset distribution for these different types of hosts. So I can explain this in more detail. If you're interested, feel free to find me later. I'm kind of skimming over the top of it. But one thing that I wanted to pitch is that for anyone that's interested in doing science with populations of compact binaries, I helped develop a code called COSMIC. So COSMIC is one of these population synthesis codes. For those of you that have read papers about them or know about them, they're notoriously kind of black boxes. There's a lot of uncertain physics that goes into them. And a lot of people that use these codes aren't really too transparent about the particular choices that they make for these uncertain physical prescriptions. So with that in mind, with COSMIC, we wanted to make it completely transparent. So this is all version controlled on Git. It has really kind of easy to understand initialization files that can actually tell people when they run and publish it exactly what went into the physics. And we made a strong effort to make this incredibly kind of user-friendly. So you can go, it's all kind of a Python front end, even though Fortran is the code under the hood, so you don't need to deal with Fortran. And you can go to this site, and you can go from pip installing it to having your own population of neutron stars or black holes or white dwarfs in a matter of 5 to 10 minutes. So if you're interested in learning more about it, feel free to come talk to me or just go to this code. We have some pretty good documentation at this site. But when we combine information from our kind of population models, we can then actually back out constraints on the, for example, natal kicks themselves that went into these two particular GRBs. And one of the things that we found was really interesting is for one of these GRBs, so 090515, which is about 75 kiloparsecs offset from its host, we found that the natal kick posterior was essentially constrained to be above 200 kilometers per second, which is the highest kind of lower limit to a natal kick, even considering all the double neutron stars in the Milky Way. So this plot is just looking at kind of the prior for this, which is the dotted line compared to the posterior, which is the recovered distribution in the histogram right here. So that's a paper that came out recently. You can find it on archive there. But what we're interested in doing down the road is doing this really for not only the full population of short gamma ray bursts to start to get some kind of population constraints on the progenitor systems, but also do this for all of the new multi-messenger events that we're going to have in the next 5 years or so. So hopefully we weren't just obscenely lucky with 170817. We'll have many more of these relatively local kind of multi-messenger events with detailed galactic characterizations so we can really kind of pair this kind of analysis maybe with cosmological simulations like Lustrous and be able to kind of model these galaxies through cosmic time and accounting for merger histories and star formation history and seeing how the kind of compact binary evolution follows. So I'm gonna end it there. Like I said, feel free to come talk to me over the next couple days. I'm gonna be around. And really the point that I wanna drive home is that we're really in this kind of new era for gravitational wave astronomy itself, because now we're not really just worried about the detections. We're really starting to think about how we can use the populations as sources and their unique characteristics to start to decipher a lot of the interesting aspects of massive star evolution. So I'll leave my conclusions up and be happy to take any questions.
So in your population modeling for the kicks, do you also allow for like satellite galaxies around these host galaxies?
No, so that's one of the reasons I was hinting at this kind of using cosmological simulations to do this instead. Right now we're constructing kind of the time-dependent potentials of these galaxies using semi-analytic relations. So essentially, we know the stellar mass of these galaxies. We can infer what the dark matter halo mass is from stellar mass halo mass relationships. And then we can essentially reverse engineer the history of this galaxy based on its evolution on the star formation main sequence.
Sure.
So these are all
But if this URV were sitting in some satellite of that computed host, then it's clicked to be zero.
Totally, yeah. So these short GRBs have, there's limits to the, there are optical limits to any potential like clusters or things at those high offsets. I don't know exactly what those limits are, but they're in some of Wenfei Fong and Ito Berger's papers.
But these are galaxies at like redshift like 0.5 or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there could certainly be some very diffuse or dim system there, and we aren't accounting for that whatsoever with this. So in reality, what they do is they kind of create, I mean, they create these kind of probability of chance coincidence statistics to say how likely it is from this host based on its stellar mass and kind of mass budget compared to any of the other things you see in the field. But there could be some hidden things exactly like you were saying that could be altering stuff.
The LMC, for example, is, you know, I mean, the galaxies that small are difficult to see at those redshifts.
Mm-hmm.
And the LMC has like lots of stars, lots of star formation in it.
That's true, but I mean, if you take the LMC star formation compared to the star formation of an active or a large galaxy, these are things that have long delay time distributions, broad delay time distributions. So they don't need to be things that are going where ongoing star formation is occurring right now. So if you can make an argument that something that has a lot more of a stellar mass budget must be contributing more of these short gamma ray bursts. But there could be some contamination from these kind of, and there will be some contamination from these systems as well.
So you discussed the different ways to tell apart field binaries versus a dynamic assembly one. What happened with the third category that you had at the very beginning?
Yeah, so.
What are smoking guns there?
So that's why I'm really kind of excited about eccentricity, because some of those other categories can have interesting, let me just go back to the slide to kind of show the landscape of it. But sorry, I didn't mean to use the same word as my title, that's kind of cheesy. But here we go. Yeah. Except it's missing one of them. Here we go. There we go. Yeah. So as far as these different ones, triples also are going to have a distinguishing feature as far as their eccentricity goes. The eccentricity distributions of triples, both in the galactic nuclei as well as in the field, look different than the eccentricity distributions predicted from globular or nuclear clusters. But that would mean we need a population, so that's more of kind of a 3G test to be able to distinguish between the two. But those triples can't really form these kind of relativistic hyperbolic captures, such as these strong encounters the nuclear and globular clusters do. So if you see a bursty source with an eccentricity of 0.9, I think that's going to be really hard for triples necessarily to do. They typically evolve into the LIGO band a bit. AGN disks, one of the kind of unique predictions there is the idea is that it's kind of like a scaled up version of planetary migration. So you have black holeitesimals, you can call them. So instead of planetesimals, you have black holeitesimals moving through this disk and getting caught in these migration traps where they can encounter other black holes quite easily and go through mergers. And one of the interesting things that's predicted from those AGN disks is they're predicted to be retained in these traps pretty well even when they go through these mergers and have their recoil kicks. So you might be able to build up not just second generation, but seventh or eighth generation black holes, which really builds up kind of this high mass ratio, which I think would be a very unique prediction of AGN disks if you start to see heavy black holes with a mass ratio of 20 to 1 or 15 to 1. POP3 stars are tough. I mean, sorry, not POP3s, but primordial black holes are tough because they expand a lot of parameter space. I think one of the kind of interesting predictions for these two scenarios would be if you had a very high mass black hole in the mass gap, so something like 100 solar masses that was non-spinning. I think that would be a really interesting thing here because even though you can get those black holes through these second generation mergers, they're going to be highly spinning. So something that's very massive and non-spinning, I don't think would fit really well into either of these two scenarios. So that's a little bit of a overview, but there's plenty of other things. Dan?
I was wondering, how does your inferred like kick velocities and all other parameters, like for the short GRBs hosts, how do they depend on like the galactic potential that you assume? Like
very, very strongly.
Right.
And one of the reasons that we wanted to do this way is, I mean, it sounds really simple, but kind of the way that people have been inferring kick velocities from these is they know the time of peak star formation of these galaxies, these host galaxies. They know the distance. So you have a distance, you have a time, you can calculate a velocity and you calculate it that way. I mean, that's, I shouldn't say it's laughable because my collaborators have done it that way, but I mean, that's neglecting any kind of the, it's not actually the kick from the supernova, it's the systemic velocity, it's neglecting any kind of galaxy evolution. So this was kind of a first try at incorporating kind of the evolution of the galaxy, because something that has a very high offset, maybe it's from something that formed with a very short delay time and received a very strong kick when the galaxy was big and bulky and had a deep potential, or something that formed at very early times when the galaxy was lighter, had a shallower potential, lower kick, and kind of took its time getting out there. So it's really important to consider the evolution of the galaxies when you're talking about the progenitors of things that have long or broad delay time distributions. So long answer for a short, I mean, long response for a short answer. It was, yeah, it's important.
So you also talked a lot about this like upper mass gap.
Mm-hmm.
Would there be any distinguishing power if we saw black holes in the so-called lower mass gap?
It's a little, yeah. So first of all, I mean, anything in that lower mass gap, it's tough that it would come from globular clusters. Globular clusters are pretty inefficient at forming neutron, merging neutron stars and forming low mass merging black holes. Lower mass gap, there's been some studies that find that it's pretty hard to resolve an individual system in that gap because the kind of the breadth of the posterior that you have on the individual masses might make it tough to see whether it actually truly falls in the gap. But then we know that there are some systems from O3 so far that have a classification that strongly puts them in the mass gap, which means that one of the two components has significant support in that 3 to 5 solar mass range. I'm actually a pessimist, and I think it's going to be really dang hard for us to tell if those things are ever neutron stars or black holes. And the reason is because for it to be a neutron star, if we want to tell that it is just from gravitational waves, we need to see tidal effects, which means we need to have a relatively low mass ratio, so you need to get pretty lucky to have a very low mass black hole with a high mass neutron star to be able to see kind of those tidal effects. And it's the same thing for any optical counterparts as well for kilonovae. I mean, if you have high mass ratios, the neutron star is just going to get swallowed up and not emit any kind of kilonova signal. So I think it's going to be really tough for LIGO itself to be able to tell if something in that mass gap is a black hole or a neutron star. But if we get lucky with a mass ratio and have an EM counterpart, then we might be able to.
May I follow up? So you mentioned the global clusters are not good to forming kind of low mass binaries. Mm-hmm. But if you were to form like a large second generation black hole, so now you're talking about whatever 30, 60 solar mass black hole, can you capture a small object that way and form binaries that way, or the proportion is just way too low?
You can theoretically. There's always a chance that the resultants of one of these kind of chaotic encounters is going to be the high mass thing with a very, very low mass thing. But statistically, you're always going to be pushed to having the high mass components be the bound binary at the end and the lower thing ejected from the interaction. So it can happen, but it's, I think, when you run the models, getting things like this and even getting like double neutron star mergers are very, very rare. So way below the rates that LIGO is already detecting, at least for double neutron star mergers.
Any other questions? Let's thank Mike again.
Thanks.